afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's edition of SMIE Consulting. My name is Marty Bennett. I'm your host for today's episode. I'm the president and founder of SMIE Consulting. And today, we'll be covering during this half-hour live chat a series of issues that have popped onto our news feeds in the last half hour, or in the last week, I should say. I'm good. I'm not that good. And we look forward to sharing with you some of our views on what's happening out in the marketplace related to international education and how these topics can be perhaps used to your benefit as an institution as you look to refine your international ed policies. So looking forward to chatting with you today on these topics, and we'll be covering two topics that we've discussed in part in other in relation to other stories before. First up is a look at a changing Vietnam and what that means for U.S. institutions looking to recruit there. We'll also be taking a deep dive into what's happened with the Seavis by the Numbers reports that was released a couple weeks ago, and going into some of the behind the scenes motivations and developments coming out of that. And we'll also have a look at the perils of international education partnerships between institutions. So we'll be looking at these three issues today as part of our weekly live chat. And for those of you who have are new to the Midweek Roundup, we do these each Wednesday to kind of look at a little bit more in depth into some stories that have popped onto the our news feeds in the last week or so. And all of the three topics that we cover each week come from our newsletter, the SMIE e-newsletter. And that comes out on Mondays. It's called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. If you'd like to subscribe to that newsletter and or see the stories that are produced each week, I've put the link to this week's edition where the three stories that we're covering today are covered in depth. And we'll go through those each week as we begin our conversations. But looking forward to these three topics today. And for those of you who would like more information about SMIE Consulting, I always encourage you to check out our website, smieconsulting.org. I'll put the link to it in the comments section on the Facebook page so that you have that for your reference. You can find a lot of free resources there from our company in terms of our consulting services that we provide, many of which are free of charge, but it's also what we can do for your institution or organization when it comes to international education strategies. So please feel free to check those out. I'm also popping up those images on for both the website and also the podcast of this live chat, the archive of which is available on all your favorite iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Stitcher, whatever your podcast provider is. Please download and subscribe to our Midweek Roundup. We'd love to keep in touch with you there if you prefer just to listen to my voice rather than watch me. So thank you very much for joining me today. First up, we'll talk about Vietnam. Now, Vietnam, for anyone who's been in international education for the last 5 years or so, knows that this country has really emerged over the last 5 to 10 years as a true giant, as it were, in terms of destination markets or source markets for U.S. institutions looking to recruit international students. In looking at the history of what's happening in Vietnam, one of the things I've done, and this article that I'm referencing today is out of IDP Connect. Used to be Hot Courses. Hot Courses was bought out by IDP. They had a rebranding this February. I do some consulting work for them and produce these articles on a monthly basis. This was the first in a series of three country-focused articles I'll be doing on Vietnam this May. Next month, we'll be looking at Brazil. And then in July, I'll be looking at India. So this Understanding Key Markets series I've just started, with the looking at Vietnam, I really take a deep dive into the history of U.S. international student relations with Vietnam, particularly since about the immediate post 9/11 era, when Vietnam started emerging as a real real powerhouse, upcoming powerhouse at the time, of student interest in the United States. In the article, I do take a look at that initial history that wasn't until actually 2006, 2007, when Vietnam entered the top 20 sending countries to the United States. And that was only when they had about 6,000 international students studying here. At that time, when Vietnam first came into the onto the scene, it was at a time when in country there were very few higher education options for students to pursue. So there was a natural push factor out from Vietnam for students looking for places. Now, what is usually unknown for most U.S. schools that are recruiting there is that Vietnam is actually the top destination for Vietnamese students is actually Japan, not the United States or UK or Canada. Interestingly, Japan being the number one source. So not entirely sure what the motivations are there, historical connect ties and such, but certainly Japan is quite a bit ahead more than double the amount of Vietnamese students are studying in Japan as they are in the United States. So what's interesting when you look at the data, though, for back in the day when in the mid-90s, you found that most Vietnamese that were coming to the United States were coming for English language studies and community college studies because, frankly, the number of post-secondary options for them in their home country was very limited. Thank you for joining, Marcy. Hope all's well with you at Valpo. Hope you're finally done with the snow and enjoying some spring weather there. Looking forward to any contributions you'd like to make today to the conversation. But with regard to Vietnam, and I know Marcy used to work at one of those colleges, those community colleges in Washington State that drew quite a few international students from Vietnam and probably still do. But back in the day, in the mid-90s, that was certainly where majority of Vietnamese students were heading. That trend has certainly changed to where now there are many more students studying at the bachelor's degree level and even now graduate studies in the United States. The way the numbers break down, if you look at the recent Sivas by the Numbers report, the just over 30,600 students from Vietnam in the United States currently at all levels. And that includes about 8,500 who are studying at the associate's degree, 11,100 at the bachelor's degree level, 2,800 at master's, 1,400 at the doctoral level. High school is a growing part of the Vietnamese students population in the U.S., where there are over 4,100 Vietnamese currently enrolled in U.S. high schools. So that may be another source of domestically based international students that you might want to be tapping into in the days and weeks to come. So Marcy, you've commented, come back, and hello, Ray. Yeah, Ray Brown, my first boss in at Marquette University is now with you at Valpo. Hope you as well. Marcy, you've mentioned 120 Vietnamese was their top number. Is that was when you were at Shoreline, or is that where you are now at Valpo? And so now it seems Vietnamese students perhaps are not going in as great a number, certainly to community colleges. And Marcy comments that perhaps they're not getting visas as easily as they used to for community colleges. So interesting to see where that story goes in the days and weeks to come. But it seems to be, based on the current numbers, there's actually up Vietnamese students in the U.S. is up 3% over where they were in the last 6 months. So that is driven by bachelor's and high school increases in the Vietnamese student populations in the United States. Actually, small increases in those areas. So we'll see where that goes. But in terms of all study destinations, as I mentioned earlier, Vietnam does send more students, many more students, 72,000 Vietnamese students currently study in Japan. U.S. is in second place with just around 30,000. But after the United States, South Korea is a number three destination. Australia and Canada round out the top five countries where Vietnamese students are going. And why do I mention these other countries? It is about, in this day and age especially, it's about your competition, knowing your competition. Not just knowing your audience, the student audiences, but knowing where they want to go as well, where they're also being attracted to study. And in Vietnam, you're looking at two other major English language speaking destinations, Australia and Canada, in the top five. And the UK is not far behind Canada in that regard. But you see now, and the data that I'll be sharing from here on out is coming from IDP Connect's Insights tool, formerly Hot Courses Insights tool, and that's available to all those that are who have are mem or clients of Hot Courses and or IDP Connect now. Now, what IDP Connect's Insights tool does, and this is where I really encourage all institutions to be able to get in terms of getting to know your market. It's not just knowing where those students that are looking at your institution are coming from, or those that are just looking at the United States, what they're interested in, but also where else they're being drawn and why they might be drawn in certain other directions. Because that's always an important piece of the puzzle that I think often gets missed. And Lou, thank you. Lou, I hope all is well. I'm glad you're back from vacation safe and sound. And I think we're all in pre-NAFSA mode right now, looking forward to catching up with you in DC. I hope all is well with your new ventures. Now, with regard to Vietnam and the breakdown of what's changing year on year, and what IDP Connect, the Insights tool, does is they've done taken a year-on-year snapshot, and that's available real time to any IDP client, to over 1.1 million Vietnamese students that are using the Hot Courses platform. And that the Hot Courses piece is still the student-facing piece that where they access information. The U.S. does have a narrow lead over its competition in that perspective. And on Hot Courses, the Australia, U.K., and Canada are the next largest competitors. But Canada's growing appeal on Hot Courses is certainly has been increasing significantly. But it is part of a larger macro trend that I think is very much worth keeping an eye on. That, according to according to this insights data on the year-on-year information, all of the major destinations for Vietnamese students have lost market share to Canada in the last year, and we know some of the reasons for that. Obviously, their current administration under the Prime Minister Trudeau is very much open door policy and welcoming students from around the world, and being much more proactive by the national level in terms of their approach and establishing policies, immigration policies, work policies that are favorable towards international students and those that want to come and stay and work in Canada. That's not the case here in the United States to the extent that anyone who works in international education would like. But certainly, Canada's efforts have been significant, and they're starting to reap the benefits of that. When you look at the United States, in terms of the market that is considering the market, the U.S. as a destination country, there's some interesting data points that are worth taking a look at, and I touch upon those in the article. Those that are on the Hot Courses platform are increasingly female, over 71%. Nearly 60% are interested in undergraduate studies. And comfortingly, less than one third are using mobile devices to access the platform. I say comfortingly because anyone who's visited Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh can share stories of mopeds and motorcycles and even taxis where people are continuously on their mobile devices. And it's comforting to know that they are at their tablets or desktops or laptops actually doing their research on Hot Courses rather than while they're on their phone on a motorbike. So happy to see that they are putting in the work that they need to really understand their options in the United States. The good news also for those who are not familiar with the academic profile of Vietnamese students in terms of what they want to study, you also see that they are not as heavily STEM focused as other major countries in India, in particular in that region, that they're actually very broadly attracted to business, health and medicine, creative arts and design, social study, social media, and then engineering are the top five areas for US bound Vietnamese students. No surprise also that they live primarily in Ho Chi Minh and Hanoi, the next large, where you see well over 80%, or excuse me, two-thirds of U.S. interested Vietnamese students on Hot Courses are in those two cities. next largest city province of origin is Da Nang, with less than 5%. So the conclusions that I came up with for this article, I think, are also worth repeating, two of which we just touched on, is that students are accessing their information from hot courses and university profiles on that site from educational institutions, either schools, colleges, test prep locations. They also, institutions, U.S. institutions, need to be looking at the comparative value proposition of their institution and their country as compared to their competitor nations, especially Canada, UK, and Australia. So Vietnam is going to be continue to be a strong market for the U.S. for the foreseeable future, but it certainly looks like the competition is certainly heating up for those students, and one that is, it's well worth U.S. institutions paying attention to why students might be aware of and attracted to other countries as primary destinations for their higher ed studies. All right, next up, I'm going to shift gears and talk about the recent Sivas by the Numbers report. This came out a couple weeks ago, and there's been several articles on it recently. I've just posted the link to the one I'm focusing on today, and that's from the Pi News, one of my favorite sources for information on international ed. And it takes a look at their title of their piece is U.S. Sivas Figures Confirm International Student Drop. So confirming what we already knew was true, that certainly the past 2 years of Open Doors data certainly reflects a decrease in the number of new international students enrolling in U.S. colleges. And even though there was a slight overall increase in numbers this past year, it was buoyed largely by increases in the number of OPT students that were looking for jobs after graduation. So primarily driven by STEM, OPT extensions and such. So the numbers will likely be reflective of this 2.7% decrease, and that would be across the board for international students in higher education institutions. This number, we should clarify, it does include vocational and also high school and primary school students from overseas enrolled in the United States. So those are, again, growing parts of the international student pie in the United States, but lesser so in terms of their overall volume, but still worth keeping an eye on. What is particularly important, I think, in terms of the numbers, there are some interactive maps on the Sivas by the Numbers site that are referenced in the Pi News article. And they talk about how certain states in the United States have seen decreases. California has seen a drop off of of about 9,000 students. Texas lost more than 5,000 students. New York lost 2,000 students. But Massachusetts saw an increase, so up about 2,000 students in the last year. So that's what the raw real-time data reflects from Sivas. Again, that's slightly different set of numbers than you see in Open Doors. Obviously, Open Doors is a year behind the Sivas by the Numbers reports from the previous academic year. But certainly, the article that the Pi News references does quote David D. Maria, Associate Vice Provost for International Ed at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's been active in NAFSA for years and in leadership there as well. And he actually testified before Congress recently on this topic. And I love the way David approached this topic. And he says should not be a shock to anyone in international ed. And that really confirms kind of his language was the canary in the coal mine stopped singing a few years back after changes were made to major scholarship programs. So a decline was inevitable. And this is all happening exclusive of any changes by the current administration in terms of policies that is potentially scaring off other prospective international students. So David's perspective here is a point well taken, obviously. And his call during his testimony before Congress, and he reflects that in the article, is for a national international ed policy, which exists in other countries, but does not exist in the United States, never has, and probably never will. But there's just no coordinating body that is capable of doing it right now, unless there's real drive and initiative from the top. And that doesn't exist presently. Because he mentions policies that actually are working well in Canada, as we know, as we've commented on before on this chat. And his comment was, while I recognize policies, priorities, and support for higher ed vary greatly across each of the 50 states, a national strategy would at least help to coordinate efforts and resources at the federal level. And he makes the point of there are certain parts of the country where there are significant declining domestic enrollments. And he says maybe there could be national incentives for international students to enroll in institutions in low domestic where domestic enrollments are declining. It could be having incentivizing recent graduates, international graduates, to pursue practical training in areas of the country where there's clear labor shortages. And that's, he also recommends that there be a focus, if there is any national policy or strategy, to also have a focus on growing the outbound U.S. student population abroad for studies. So it's a great summary, I think, and David's comments are certainly well taken and certainly reflect a lot of what we've talked about here on the chat before, is how important it is for institutions to really, and for the country as a whole, to again be aware of what our competition are doing, and also take steps to advocate to our elected leaders about the value of what international education brings to our communities, but also to, and to our campuses, obviously. But you also see some bright spots in this article. There's references to another colleague of mine, Joel Weaver, co-founder of Study Hawaii. And he comments that they're not worried in Hawaii as with this drop. They keep their ear to the ground as much as anyone in terms of trends, but they have been taking steps. I'm working with their state government to obtain some funding over the past few years, and are looking at ways to collaborate more with their state organizations, trade offices, as well as the educational institutions that they're already working with, to maintain and enhance the pipelines of students that they have, particularly in their English language sector, where they have remained to be very competitive and have strong flows coming from East Asia, Japan and Korea being two of the more common largest areas that they've seen continued focus and interest from in Asia. So the challenge is really for institutions to make sure our senior leadership really understand the landscape that we're operating in. They live within their own states and even potentially smaller bubbles that they might operate within in terms of what defines what they do. But it also is a challenge for us as institutions, as international educators, to keep our leadership aware, not just on our campuses, but again in our communities, of what's going on. And part of one of those issues that always flares up from time to time whenever there's an international incident that involves international education or international students in one way or another, and that has to do with partnerships, international partnerships. And we saw recently we've seen a lot of this last fall, where there was a great deal of concern on the part of U.S. institutions related to institutional partnerships in Saudi Arabia. And it's all centered around the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was actually in the United States as working for the Washington Post as a contributor, but he had gone to the embassy or the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and was never seen again, and was later proved to have been murdered by Saudi nationals that were sent by members of the Saudi higher of the, if not the royal family, then certainly the ministries of security and what have you, in country, sent to take care of him, because he was. It wasn't particularly vitriolic in terms of a journalist, in terms of his opinions on the kingdom, but certainly he was seen as a threat and was eliminated. And that certainly set a lot of balls in motion on college campuses, particularly those that have institutional partnerships with Saudi Arabian institutions, and that's led to a lot of soul searching on behalf of a lot of administrators, a lot of international educators, a lot of faculty that were involved in partnership building with institutions in those countries. So what we've seen come out of that is the folks like MIT, they did their own internal investigations and realized that while they certainly did not approve of what had happened with Khashoggi's murder, they decided not to cut ties that were valued in the millions of dollars, obviously, with a school like MIT. Other institutions may have done examinations, but none really were public at all in terms of their willingness to cut ties with a government that was seen to be taking the law into its own hands and murdering its own citizens for speaking their mind, and that's not something new. Certainly, from the kingdom or in many countries around the world, but certainly raised a lot of eyebrows. What's happening now is very interesting because we're actually seeing at this point there are movements underfoot to expand scholarship programs again from the kingdom, perhaps not on the same scale as they had been previously, but there are now new groups of potentially graduate students that will be coming in the fall or next spring, or a year from now, fall, to U.S. institutions that are looking at graduate programs. In fact, a largely female group is on its way in the next year to U.S. institutions that I'll be working with in part through one of my consulting opportunities. So there's signs of life there, but has it impacted what's happened? Is that a result of what's happening after the post Khashoggi era? We're not too sure, but posting now the third story that I'm commenting on today, and that's from another colleague of mine, Liz Reisberg, who we served together on the ECE board of directors for a couple of years. She's just cycled off the board, but she's been an excellent voice in international ed. She's been research fellow at the Center for International Higher Ed at Boston College for a number of years, where she lives in Boston. And she writes very well. Her area of expertise is in Latin America and Saudi Arabia, in fact. She's had numerous projects she's worked with in the kingdom over the years. But she is a great resource for me personally and professionally. But she has an important eye on what's happening. And her most recent piece, she coordinates the Global View blogs for Inside Higher Ed as well. And she's her latest piece is to engage or to disengage. And this is looking at institutional partnerships. She had written previously on the post-Khashoggi balance of power in terms of where institutions were going on with their views with institutional partnerships with the kingdom. But now she's taken in this article kind of a broader view on how and why universities decide to end ties with the university partners overseas. And she goes all the way back to Vietnam, looking at how academic community had a role in contributing to the end of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, or how they helped in accelerating the end of apartheid in South Africa by talking about divestment and at that time in the 80s, to looking at some of the current institutions that are dealing with Saudi Arabia, but also she references a particular case with the University of Cape Town in South Africa that has recently taken the position that they should divest their relationships with University of Cape Town. The Faculty Senate, the Faculty Senate at the University of Cape Town voted to boycott academic engagement with Israel. And so there were a number of U.S. partner institutions that got together and wrote a joint letter opposing that these are existing partners of the University of Cape Town that have written a letter opposing this faculty vote, opposing academic collaboration with Israel. So very interesting to see this happening. And Liz, I think, takes the perspective here that it's one thing when universities decide not to work with other countries because of policies of a government. It's an entirely different thing when a government intrudes on the academic enterprise itself. That's where I think she is certainly much more comfortable, and I think many folks would be related to if a foreign government is interfering in what academic institutions are doing in their own countries, then that's a real problem and reason to be seriously concerned about whether those relationships need to be maintained. And she references on that front the expanding wake of Confucius Institutes that have closed here in the United States, and she references some in the UK that have closed, and throughout Europe that have already cut ties with Confucius Institutes. That you have when there's clear indications that these bodies are acting as agents of the government to monitor their own students and scholars abroad, let alone be used as propaganda tools in one way or another. This is something that I think is really, really interesting to keep an eye on, because we're looking at changes even within the United States to changes in publicly funded research that may or may not be, if it doesn't align with the government's ideology, then that may be cut in future. And that's, there's talk about that happening here in the U.S., but it's happening in Hungary and Brazil. So there's real challenges in terms of when you have government influencing other countries' academic institutions. And that's where I think she would draw the line. And many, many reasonable folks might disagree on that. But certainly there are a lot of former gray areas that are becoming much more clear when it comes to institutional partnership as to what guides institutions in the way they operate and extend their relationships abroad. So certainly a perilous way, whatever way you look at it. But just want to conclude tonight with today's podcast and round up here with just a call to any of you who will be at NAFSA. Please get in touch and let me know. Happy to schedule a time where we can reconnect, if not at a reception, certainly during the walks around the exhibit hall or what have you. Looking forward to reconnecting with you all then. For now, that's the end of this week's roundup, and look forward to chatting with you again in the weeks to come. Cheers.